How many are? School story.
We're going to call to order the Senate Committee on Education Interim Committee.
And I'm calling to order the Interim Committee on House Education.
And we're going to do a quick introduction. We'll start with, to my right, since there's nobody over there, we'll start to my left. We'll harass my senator. There's not a senator over there. I'm the Senate Committee Chair.
Thank you for clarifying.
Not a senator over there.
I'll get him, you guys.
Thank you for defending.
So we'll start over with my good co-chair of this joint committee.
Oh.
And you can, and the other statement you want too.
Thank you, Representative Doherty from House District 35, Tigerton, Southwest Portland.
Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43, that's Lloyd Center, North and Northeast Portland.
Senator Jeff Cruz, just a farmer from Southern Oregon, pretty much.
State Rep Carl Wilson, District 3, Grants Pass.
Carla Paluso, State Rep, District 50, the great city of Gresham.
Sarah Gelser, State Senator, Senate District 8, Corvallis and Albany.
Representative Susan McClain from House District 29, out in West Washington County.
And now we'll go to the representatives to my right, yes.
Greg Barreto, State Rep, House District 58, Wallowa County, Union County, and part of Umatilla County.
Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48, Outer Southeast Portland, down into Happy Valley.
Sherry Springer, State Rep, House District 17, and since we're naming towns, I'm from Sile. I represent Lebanon, Waterloo, Sweet Home State, and Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana. Do I win?
Actually, you don't, because I can't go on mine.
Representative, you only win because I didn't name all of mine.
I did.
I know. And I'm Arnie Robin, Senate District 5, and I have too many to mention, but I have seven. I could do my seven counties before I get into the cities. But I start in Coos Bay, just south at the Charleston Bridge, and I go to 3rd Street in Tillamook and the whole west side of Tillamook Bay, and then over to Sheridan and Falls City in the valley. So parts of seven counties. And with that, I'd also, it's a special week, and we'll let Representative Doherty have a little statement before we get going.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I don't know if any of you, of course, all you're celebrating this week, but this week is American Education Week, and it's always the week before Thanksgiving. And a lot of people don't realize that American Education Week, which honors teachers, administrators, parents, substitutes, educators, or classified, everyone in the education field, was actually, the talks began in 1919. Between the National Education Association and the American Legion. And the reason was, as the draftees during World War I, 25% of them were illiterate, and 9% of them were so malnourished they had a lot of difficulty performing their duties as soldiers. So they got together, formed American Education Week, and the purpose is to celebrate public education to honor individuals who are making a difference for children. And so the first American Education Week was in 1921. So this is, I think, very appropriate, but this is our week.
And with that, we'll have our latest joining member introduce himself.
Thanks, Arnie.
You're welcome.
You caught me on my feet here. All right. Senator Herman Baratrigger, District 2, which is Grants Pass and North Jackson County.
So with that, we are going to have two in this group, just so people understand. So we're going to have two presentations to the joint committees, and then the Senate committee will retire to just down the hall to Senate. I think we're in C?
B.
B. No, we're in B. To B for the last half when we are separated. But we have two short hearings today, informational. And the first one, so we will open an informational hearing on early intervention and early childhood special education update. And so those who are going to speak can come on up to the dais and start that presentation. And I do want to thank, you know he's not part of this, Ozzie Rose sitting in the back for helping get this organized. So thank you, Ozzie.
Good Good morning, Chairs Roblin and Doherty. Thank you very much for having us here this morning. I think, actually, Senator Roblin, the fishing grounds that you cover means that you might win.
That's right.
Impressive area, I have to say. It's a pretty impressive fishing area. At any rate, thank you all very much for taking the time to allow us to present to you this morning on early intervention, early childhood special education. For the record, I'm Rob Saxton, Superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD. Wow, I almost reverted to old titles. Superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD. And it's great to be here this morning. So we are going to talk about early intervention, early childhood special education, also known as EI, ECSE. So either of those two things I hope will suffice as we talk today. And we're going to talk about the programming and the funding that we find right now with EI, ECSE. So if you could this morning, I know it's a little bit early, but if you could just for a moment with me imagine that either you or your children have just had a new infant, your baby or your grandchild, or maybe it's a niece or a nephew brand new to this world, and it's such an exciting, incredible time in your life, and you have such hopes and dreams and beliefs about this child, and there's so much incredible love that you feel for this baby. And then you start to watch them grow, and you go visit other family members, or you go to your play group for the first time, and you recognize that the other babies are smiling, but yours hasn't. And you know that maybe that could be a sign of autism. Or you notice that some of the other babies are beginning to crawl and yours is not. And you wonder if there is some other kind of possible delay. And so you go and you have them evaluated and you find out that indeed there is some kind of a delay. And you are referred so that you can go get some support from early intervention, early childhood special education. One of the things that you know, or that you'll learn as soon as you're referred, is that the brain development that occurs in the first 4 years of a child is the primary brain development time. That 90% of our brain is formed up by age four. And that with really great intervention, there's an opportunity, the best opportunity that this child, who you care so dearly about, is ever going to have to get as much possible brain development as they're going to achieve as quickly as possible, their best opportunity to make the best gains that they're going to experience over the entire course of their lifetime is right now. And if you can meet with some people who can tell you a little bit about how to interact with your child in the most effective way so that you can stimulate that brain development, or if they can begin to interact with that child in a way that will stimulate that brain development and help overcome either the delay or the disability as best as possible, you have a great opportunity for the child to have the best hope for success over time. And when you go and meet with people, what you find out is that you're going to get 2.5 hours of service per month. Per month. Because honestly, that's exactly what we're doing right now in the state of Oregon. We're identifying children in this state who have a delay, that we know have a delay, that we know that our best opportunity to have them prepared to be successful, the best opportunity that we have to intervene and work with their parents so that they can help their child be as successful as possible, is right now during this 4 or 5 year time frame. And we give them 2.5 hours of service per month. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the program that we have in place. We want you to know what EI, ECSE is. We want you to know what EI, ECSE does for children. We want you to understand what the recommended service level is, a service level that was recommended by our legislature through a committee process. We also want you to know what parents and children actually receive and what kinds of issues that brings to our youngest children who we want desperately to make sure are going to be prepared to be successful in kindergarten, who need to be part of our 40-40 solution, because 40-40-20 is everybody. And that if we don't appropriately fund this, we cannot get there. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to people who are more expert about EI, ECSE, and I'll let them introduce themselves. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Judy Newman, and I'm a member of the State Interagency Coordinating Council and also a co-director of Early Childhood Cares, which provides services to in early intervention, early childhood special ed. My job today is sort of the meat and potatoes to tell you what this is all about and hopefully bring some of the information to light. Thank you, Rob, for setting the context so meaningfully. So what do early intervention and early childhood special ed services really look like? And how do you actually provide special education to children before they actually start school? We know that we know what it looks like in schools, but it's very different with this age group of children under 5 years of age. And because they spend their time at home, they spend their time in child care, and they spend their time in preschool. It begins with a referral to EIECSC programs. A child may already have a diagnosed disability, or they may have a suspected disability or developmental delay. Anyone can really make a referral to these services. So if a child enters with a completed developmental screening, which many children do now, that screening is reviewed for further action. And if a child does not enter with a completed developmental screening, they receive one upon referral. Based on this information, the results from the screening, a more complete developmental assessment may be recommended, provided, and eligibility determined. This is done usually in a familiar place for the child, in their home, in their child care setting, or in a preschool. For most parents, this is a very scary time, as you can imagine, as you're going through all of these steps of the process. And I just want you to know that it's done with great sensitivity and respect for parents. After that, an IFSP, or an individualized plan, is developed in partnership with the child's parents. Now, this plan is like a roadmap, and it shows where the child is now and what they need to learn next and what their parents need to help them become better parents and help their child learn to grow and develop. It identifies what services and supports are needed to achieve these goals, how much is needed, who will provide them, where this will happen, and most often the services are provided in natural environments for children or with typical peers if they're preschool age. Then the services and supports begin, and the progress is monitored on a regular basis. Now, this sounds like a lot, and it really is. There's a lot of steps involved getting kids into the program. But it's important for you to know that all of this is completed within 45 calendar days for children under the age of 3. And for kids over the age of 3, they only have 60 days to get that child into services. So this is a very, very strict requirement, and it's monitored. So this happens in a timely manner. So the development and implementation of the IFSP is a dynamic process and a team effort for parents and family members, teachers, and professionals involved with the child. All this planning together is to ensure the child continues to learn and develop, and the parents get the skills and support they need to help their own child. What is a recommended service level, you might ask? So many programs that you're familiar with have required service levels. So when you think of Head Start, they have a certain number of days and hours that they have to have kids in school. When you think of Healthy Families Home Visiting Program, they have required caseloads. They can't go over these maximums. But for early intervention, early childhood special ed, that's not the case because services are really supposed to be individualized. But some guidance really is needed and helpful. So a group of experts, at the request of the legislature several years ago, a group of experts in EIECSE from various disciplines reviewed the literature and the research, and they identified guidelines for what constitutes an adequate service level for children to progress and close the developmental gaps in these early years. In this process, they consider children of various levels and needs and various ages. After all, one size, as we know, doesn't fit all, and dosage is very, very important to making progress. So, Children with low needs, let me describe what that looks like. We looked at kids with low needs, and we sort of defined them. You can see the developmental areas up there. They usually have delays in one or two areas. So some examples would be kids with communication disorders or mild cerebral palsy or maybe just social communication needs. Then we're looking at children with moderate needs, and they have developmental delays documented in three or four developmental areas. And these can be children like that have Down syndrome or children with autism spectrum disorder that are functioning pretty well. And then children with high needs have developmental delays in all areas to a very significant degree. They often have sensory impairments and multiple problems. These are children with autism spectrum disorder and really high behavior needs, children with various genetic disorders, for example. So parents with that have children at all these ages and at all these levels of involvement, they're always considered important. And really, a big job of ours in early intervention, early childhood special ed, is to work with families, because that's our very best investment in parent education. Because, you know, after all, they're with their kids more time, and they're with their kids over the long haul. They're going to be the best support and advocate for them. So what are the issues? We need to help each child be ready for kindergarten. For children eligible in EI-ECSE, this means we need to help kids close the developmental gap, and in some cases, they actually catch up to their typical peers. And we always want to minimize the negative impact of any kind of developmental delay or disability. In order to do this, we need to ensure there is sufficient funding to provide the adequate service levels recommended by experts and research. This is not happening. Service levels have been gradually declining due to increases in eligible children and funding that has not kept pace with the growth in costs and numbers. This has largely happened because, unlike any other program, early intervention, early childhood special ed cannot have a wait list. So everyone who is identified, whenever they are identified in that short timeline, must be served. This is both a great asset, I think, to this program, and also a great challenge. You'll hear parents talk about early intervention, early childhood special ed programs as being their life support. Probably many of you have heard parents in these hearings. They learned how to help their child and how child care providers and preschool children could include their child in those settings. And they've established trusting relationships with their service provider. But you know what you'll also hear from these same parents? That even despite the valuable help, that they really need more time, more home visits, more services. It's not enough, really, to meet the need. So the data speaks for itself. Only 30.4% of early intervention children, those are the birth to three-year-old kids, received adequate services. And I'm just highlighting 2014. You can see the trend if you look in the slide. 61.1% of early childhood special ed age kids with mild delays received the service levels they need. Now, that's our best number, but it's still just a little bit over half the kids getting that adequate level. Only 6.9% of ECSE children in the moderate category received adequate services. And lastly, 1.4% of ECSE children in the high needs category received adequate services. If you think back to Rob's example of this being your child or your grandchild, you know, how would you be feeling if you saw these numbers? So we've been tracking service levels in EI-ECSE across the state for over 10 years. For between 2004 and 2011, early intervention services decreased by 66.7%, and early childhood special ed services have decreased by 43.3%. This is really not acceptable. We do not expect this situation to improve either. What? Yes.
I don't follow that last chart quite.
This one?
Yeah. Is it the 18.6 per month? Is that
that's the average
of service
kids
they
get?
Receive?
Yes. Okay. Which was a decrease of 66.7% over that time period.
Okay.
So 7 years ago, they were getting 66.7% more time.
That's an issue. But we really are awake up here, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense to you now?
Yeah.
Thank you. So we don't expect this to get better without increased funding, because we're already identifying children at a higher rate than projected during this biennial budget. So the budget was built this year on a projection of 2.18% growth rate. And in November this year, which isn't even 6 months into this biennium, we're identifying kids at 3.33%. So that's a much higher rate already, and we anticipate that getting larger, because we attribute much of this to the accelerated the growth rate because of the state CCO incentive target to screen all children under the age of 3. So there's already been a marked increase, and we know the number is going up. In my program alone, last year, in 1 year, we increased 10% over the year before in EI age kids that were eligible. That's a huge increase. So this is also great. We should be identifying kids as early as possible and getting them help. But we also must ensure that adequate help is there for them.
Thanks, Judy. Hi, I'm John Rexford. I'm the superintendent of the High Desert Education Service District in Central Oregon. We're also the regional early childhood contractor serving Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties, and work with partners in Harney as well as Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties. I'm also a recovering K-12 superintendent. I was a deputy superintendent, served 23 years with Ben Lapine Schools. And I can really see the downstream impact, the difference we make with these kids at this age, and what we can do with them once we get them into the K-12 system is profoundly impacted by the services they receive in EIECSE. For me, this is a simple challenge. Restricted funding over the last decade has led to declining service levels. Judy illustrated that clearly. The rise in developmental screening is sharply increasing our caseloads, and so I just want to share a couple of charts that bring that back home. Funding per child has fallen behind rising costs. Over the last 5 biennia, we've been essentially flat with a little bit of a bump in this most recent biennium. I call your attention to the shortest blue bar there. You see that in 2011-13, we had a tough time making ends meet and serving children. In our region, it meant we cut 20 days of services to kids in that biennium to meet the budget restraints that we had. I want to talk a little bit about the rolling average that we use to mark our enrollment. Because of the dramatic but regular variation in students over a year, starting in September and rising usually through August, when we exit another cohort into kindergarten, we use a rolling average to track the number of kids. And that does a great job of stabilizing funding, making sure we smooth the ups and downs, and it really works well in a stable environment. But what it does do in a sharply increasing environment is really suppress the growth rate over a month. So we have 5% more kids in a month, just a 1/12 of that gets added to our rolling average, and we are in fact facing that. Even under that scenario, you see that our rolling average for the last 2 months, and now a number that I didn't get into the chart, for 3 months, our rolling average has really started to blow through the estimate from the Legislative Fiscal Office. I wanted to just dive down into that a little more and look at some year-over-year growth. So this looks at last October and the number of kids that we have this October, and look at that increase. In red, you'll see in calendar 2014, we're actually very flat. In fact, we had several months of negative growth. That is, we had a few fewer kids to serve in a given month over the year before. But you'll see, beginning in December, the last one on the right, the last red bar on the right, we started to see that effect of that increased developmental screening. And in fact, every month since February, we've exceeded the estimate from the Legislative Fiscal Office for increases in this coming year. And we are just blowing through it in the most recent months at a rate 2 to 3 times what that rolling average projects. We think that is going to lead to at least an additional 700 kids in the biennium.
And that doesn't seem like many when we're looking at over 500,000 K-12 kids, or in this case, 20-some thousand kids served over the biennium. But it turns out to be real money and real impact to the services of the children that we're serving in our programs. Once we translate that to budget implications, we estimated 23,477 students that we would serve in that biennium, so that's counting kids twice during the year, the 2 years. We think we're going to blow through that and serve an additional 700 kids to maintain the delivery of the minimum service level that we've been describing. It looks like we're going to need an increase in the budget of about $5.4 million in this biennium. The number is pretty clear, but the impacts, I think, are profound. I've got one more number that I'd like to share with you. I know that in our region that we serve in our early intervention program about 200 kids. About 400 kids, 200 kids. And of those kids, about 20% of them won't need further services. So we can make a difference. About 40 kids will not need further services after we've served them 0 to 3. That's 40 kids that won't need services next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. That is a lot of money that we don't need to put back into those kids. We've tuned them up, we've sent them on the way, but probably most importantly, we've affected the trajectory of their lives by just putting a little bit of service in the front end when it matters the most.
Sandra? Hello, my name is Cassandra Trout. I hold hats in this field, but most importantly, I am here today because I am a parent of a child with a very rare genetic disorder that has caused some significant impairments to his development. My son, Ben, who you can see on the screen there, is now 5. But our family began working with our early intervention program when he was only 2 months old. We found out very early that he would need help. Our service providers have worked with us every year to identify his current needs, which have always been very significant, and to ensure that we always knew the best strategies and techniques to help meet those needs. His early intervention team has been the foundation of our family's support system and has had a profound impact on his development. He finally learned how to walk after he turned 3 years old, but he finally learned how to walk. And he still cannot speak, but he's starting to respond to his name. And thanks to our local program that sent my husband and I to a training, he is starting to use picture exchange communication to communicate, which is huge. We have had zero communication up to this year. You know, we have all heard that the parent is the child's first and best teacher in these early years. And children learn so much by listening to us and watching us and interacting with us. But if you think about it, as a parent, what if you have a child who cannot hear you because he has a hearing loss or isn't watching you because he's more interested in his hands than anything else in the room, or doesn't even want to make eye contact with you, let alone interact with you? What do you do? How do you help that child learn? For many families, we begin to lose hope. We don't know how to help. And that's what happened to our family. But early intervention and early childhood special education helped to rebuild that hope by giving the families the tools they need to help their children succeed. Our specialists made a difference for Ben, not because of the short amount of time they were able to spend with him, but because of what they taught my husband and I. You know, as you heard earlier, in Oregon, of the children with the most significant needs, like Ben, he is delayed in every single area of his development. Less than 2% are actually receiving the service levels that are recommended by research and best practices and by the team of experts that the legislator put together to find out what those service levels should be. And funding has not kept pace with the new children being identified for services, and service levels have decreased substantially. You know, when I meet and speak with families whose children are now older but have been through early intervention or early childhood special education, I learn that they had received many more hours in services when their child was the same age. And I worry about Ben's future, and I worry about whether he's getting what he needs to develop to his full potential and be as independent as he can when he's older. Evidence shows that if we invest in these children now, when they are young, we save so much when they go to the formal K through 12 schooling. Oregon has invested in early intervention and early childhood special education in order to change the lives of these children and families. So we need to actually invest enough to be able to provide the service levels that are going to be effective in making those changes. Thank you so much.
So just a quick summary, and I think you've heard this, but I do think it's important for you to hear it sort of in short order, and that is that we currently have an inadequate level of service. The legislature convened a committee. They identified the appropriate levels of service. 30.4% of children in early intervention get that level of service. 64.1% of those who are identified with low needs get the level of service identified. 6.9% of children with moderate needs get that level of service, and only 1.4% of children with high needs get the level of service that you yourself have identified as appropriate. The state is spending huge amounts of money right now to ensure that we're doing a good job around early childhood and with coordinated care in the state, and they are doing more screening than they've ever done before so that we can identify these children as early as possible, which means that the numbers of children that we're, because we're screening more, we're identifying so many more children who need these services and who will benefit from them as they move forward and become a K through 12 child or K through 12 student. And yet we haven't increased the funding level to keep up with the additional identification. So we're identifying more kids and we don't have anything to give them. There are no waiting lists in EIUCSE. Children must be served. And so all that we do when we have more children and no more money in an already inadequate service level is thin the soup to a point that there's no nutrition for anyone in the soup. And we end up really not giving any child what it is that they need. We've identified $5.3 million as our ask. That would be an ask that would keep up with the level of service, the inadequate level of service that we're already currently providing. If we're going to provide more service to the children who are identified in the program, it's going to take more than 5.3. We're asking for 5.3 because we're told that there isn't a whole lot as you head into the February session. Obviously, we think that more than that would do a better job. Every day in my new job, I hear from superintendents who come to the ESD and say, Rob, when are you going to start up some early K-12, so kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, programs for students who that would be behavior programs? Because we've got kids who are showing up in kindergarten, first, second, and third grade that are different than anything we've ever seen before. We've got educators, both teachers and classified, who are being hurt on a regular basis as they try to work with these children. Different than we've ever seen before. And we've got to figure out how that we're going to deal with this, and you've got to start some programs for us. Those programs are super expensive. And part of the reason that we need to put those programs in place is because we're not doing the job in EIECSE. And we can do the job in EIECSE. We have every mechanism in place. All we need is a little bit of a bump in resource so that we can put that mechanism to work the way that we need to put it to work. And so that's a significant concern. The last thing that I want to share with you, and it's not something that is the right reason. The right reason is because we have kids and parents who need this, and it is a good downstream investment for the state of Oregon to take care of these kids when brain development is its highest. It's the right thing to do by them. But the other thing I want you to know is that when I was the deputy superintendent here in the state of Oregon, I spent 3 years, the entire 3 years that I was in that chair, across from a group of people at least this many that flew out from Washington, D.C. once a month to sue the state around the services that we were providing to children with special needs. And it had to do with the sheltered workshops and the transition services that we gave to kids from the time that they went to high school out into the world of work. And the U.S. government sued us in Lane v. Kitzhaber and then Lane v. Brown. And we finally settled that lawsuit this last summer. And it was very expensive for the state of Oregon, way more expensive than what I'm talking about here today. You have identified a service level that you're not meeting. I do not understand, in one of the most heavily litigated areas of education, in fact, the most heavily litigated areas of education, that the state of Oregon has not been sued on this issue yet. It is simply a matter of time. And the 5.3 that we're asking for is nothing compared to the lawsuit that we are destined to lose as a state, because we haven't done the job providing the level of resource that is required to meet the needs of these children. And it will be something that we will need to see happen if we cannot get this level of service taken care of for kids. Thank you. Be happy to answer questions.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank you all for the presentation. The first time I ever came into this building and participated in anything, I sat in exactly the chair that Cassandra is sitting in and had next to me my four-year-old, who was in early intervention, early childhood special ed services. It may have been a sign that he then walked out the door and threw up in the hallway. But we came back anyway. He, like your son, was identified as delayed in every single area. And it's shocking to me now to listen to my constituents talk about the services that they receive. And I went back to look at his services. He got speech with a speech therapist at home once a week for 30 minutes as a toddler. Also, twice a week for 30 minutes at home, services with a physical therapist. Twice a week, services at home with an occupational therapist. Twice a week at a school, a speech and motor group. And then once every other week, a services coordinator, a special educator, came to consult with me and help talk to me about my nonverbal child. How did I point out to him what he was seeing in the world and letters and all of these things that he couldn't talk about? I know that now, as a kid who's 21 and talking about who he wants to go out with on his 21st birthday, that set the stage for where he was at, for the things that make his life good, reading. He reads history books. He reads Gregory Maguire all the time. He rides his three-wheeled bicycle. All of those were things that EI set the foundation for. And then a couple of years ago, in what I think was a very concrete example of why these services are so important, he was having a different medical problem. We saw a physician who did this assessment of him and testing reflexes and all these other things, and he said, oh my gosh, this kid must have had really good and consistent physical therapy services when he was a child, because it makes no sense to me why he can walk. He would not have had access to those physical therapy services if it were not for early intervention and early childhood special ed, because you cannot go out and buy them. It is not covered by insurance, so unless you have the ability out of pocket to pay for a physical therapist who does not exist in your community to provide those services, the child doesn't get the services, and the impact is very, very real. So we talk about the kids, the importance of that investment in the kids that come in and they get the tune out and they move back. I would argue that investment in kids like Ben and Sam really pay off in the long run. And I know that those are the skills that are going to help Sam meet the goals that we've just settled in that lawsuit, to go out to be able to work independently in the community at a competitive wage. For the kids that we talk about that are in behavior programs in our schools that are really struggling, these are kids that are trying to communicate something. What if when they were in early intervention and nonverbal, we had given them the tools to communicate what they needed to do so they didn't need to flail and hit and do things that are very difficult to manage just because they're trying to communicate something? These are investments that pay off across the board, and I'm just so grateful. And to Cassandra, it's great to see the pictures of Ben. And when I think back to, to my time as the parent of a five-year-old entering kindergarten, I sometimes wish I could have looked ahead to see this young adult that's with me now, and to know it's all going to be okay, and not just okay, but really fantastic. So stick with it. There are only really, really great things ahead.
Any other questions? Quickly, so.
Well, just quickly, yes. And then never mind. I'm just going to tell you a short story, but never mind.
I just want to say thank you. It sets the stage for us to have real conversations at the legislature. And Cassandra, we assume that you'll be sitting up here in a little while. So, again, thank you very much for a very, very well done presentation to give us an understanding. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll close our informational hearing, however that goes, and we will open a public hearing information session on culturally responsive pedagogy and practices initiative presentation. And you guys can come on up, whoever's going to do the presentation, and we'll have them introduce themselves. And I want to say that Representative Doherty and I went to Teaching with a Purpose conference up in Portland. We didn't stay the whole time because we had other kinds of things, but we're exceedingly impressed with the presentations that were made at the beginning of that to set the stage. And we both agreed at that time that we wanted to have a meeting and have people hear a little bit about what's happening in a conference that has begun in the Portland area and is now reached, if you listen to the people who identified where they came from, people all over the country, and we are excited about that. So with that, we'll have introductions. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin and Joint Education Committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to come and share our work with you today. My name is Tanya Lubis, and I'm a professor and director of the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices at Eastern Oregon University. Today we're going to share with you the work that we have done as a result of House Bill 3233, which was set to establish a network of quality teaching and learning and was passed in 2013. This piece of legislation led to an establishment of grants through the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon Educational Investment Board to fund projects centered in culturally responsive pedagogy and practices and focused on the Oregon equity lens. The Teaching with Purpose Conference and Teaching with Purpose Institute, as well as the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices, were just two of the funded initiatives. Today we'd like to share with you some of the information about this work and how it should be leveraged in order to support the equitable educator and diversifying teacher education plans. The work we'll present reinforces the power that equitable education can have in changing the educational climate that oppresses ethnic and linguistic diverse students and fails to recognize the contributions that all students are capable of making in order to foster a future that elevates the value of all members of society. Specific details about the background, history, and linkage to current initiatives can be found in the concept paper that you've all been given this morning. And there is also detailed information about our projects, including testimonials that is available via the OLIS link. This morning, I'd like to start by sharing with you the work of the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices at Eastern Oregon University. This was established in order to provide a network of professional development for pre-service teachers and P20 educators in Eastern Oregon. The center serves as a resource center on materials for culturally responsive pedagogy and practices and provides professional development through strong partnerships with local school districts, charter schools, and educational service districts. And it is led by internationally acclaimed scholars who specialize in culturally responsive research and practices. The center also houses the Oregon Teacher Pathway Program, which is a pipeline program to recruit and retain ethnic and linguistic diverse teachers into education. The center is grounded in the belief that everyone has the ability to learn and achieve and has the right to be provided optimal learning environments that are responsive to their cultural and linguistic needs. As the educational landscape changes and we see more culturally and linguistic students in our classrooms, it's important that our teachers are prepared to meet their needs and foster success. However, these environments cannot happen without specific professional development and training for educators. This kind of training is that which we provide at the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices and the work that Karanja will talk about shortly. The goal of creating strong continuity between home and school and increasing student success is what we're looking for. With the help of grant funding last year, the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices was able to reach and form strong partnerships with educational agencies in 5 counties in Eastern Oregon. 198 educators across P20 roles were reached through the center's actions to date. This includes over 50 teachers and administrators from partner school districts, 40 members of EOU's faculty and staff, 59 undergraduate and graduate teacher candidates, and 48 Oregon Teacher Pathway students. Many other educators from around the nation have also participated in our work through the live streams and discussions available on our websites. The Center serves as a model for culture-responsive practices and programming and has been recognized as a best practice that can lead to the development of culture-responsive education. This is work that should be replicated across the state of Oregon and colleges of education and will place Oregon on the map as a leading in the critical work necessary to facilitate significant change in our educational systems. With continued support, the EOU Center can maintain and be sustained and have a strong model that will foster the development of replicated programs across the state. And I'd like to close the segment by sharing one of the 11 testimonial letters that we received in the last week. While each of the letters within the packet on OLIS is very strong and does impact, provide the impact of the work we're giving, I have chosen a letter to share with you that was written by three of our local high school students. And the letter is as follows. Dear Legislative Education Committee members, we were the students in the Oregon Teacher Pathway Program through Eastern Oregon University at McLaughlin High School in Milton Freewater, Oregon. Last year, as part of the course, we were given the opportunity to see some amazing scholars in the field of culturally responsive pedagogy. 50% of the student body at our school is of color, with the majority of those being Latino. Very few of us have had teachers that reflect our ethnic and linguistic diversity. It's been a struggle to feel empowered, respected, and heard in our classes. The first speaker we saw was Dr. Geneva Gay. Her talk was so inspirational and made us look critically at the education we were receiving from our teachers. We felt that the information she shared about how to become more culturally responsive was a message our teachers needed to hear. We organized a lesson on cultural responsiveness for our teachers. All of us took our own time after school to work with our teachers during a staff meeting. The results were amazing. We were able to give them specific examples of how they can improve their teaching and communication strategies and help us feel more welcome in their classrooms. They were able to see where their curriculum was leaving out our history and our accomplishments. After that staff training, we started seeing small changes and were very excited. The other speakers were just as motivating. We know that only a handful of our teachers from our school participated in training at the Center for Culture Responsive Practices at EOU, but the message is reaching a bigger audience. Our hope is that there are future speakers so that more of us can hear her message and hear what a responsive and equitable education looks like. Sincerely, Oceana Cook, Rigo Ponce, and Giselle Flores. At this time, I'll turn the remaining portion of the presentation over to my colleague, and we will answer questions at the end. Thank you again for your time.
First, I want to thank our chair, Senator Roblin, and Representative Doherty for this opportunity to come speak before you all. My name is Karanja Cruz. I am an educator in Portland, Oregon. I've been a teacher for 12 years. I would have to say I've been an effective teacher for 12 years because I teach with a mindset, what I teach with a purpose. And what that means is I teach to empower. I teach to empower my students. I started out in the Beaverton School District, and I finished my career in the Portland Public School District. And the reason why I want to say I started out in Beaverton, because my first 4 years was in a predominantly affluent white community. And when we talk about culturally relevant pedagogy and responsiveness, I had to become that. Me being from Northeast Portland and being in an environment that's not an affluent community, I was able to easily adapt because I built relationships with my students. And that's what I want to talk to you guys about today. So culturally relevant pedagogy and practice, the request for funding. So first of all, I want to start out by stating this work is very important to me, and it touches home because my children... my two children that you see here, and this is Aaron, they attend one of the lowest performing schools in the state. And I want you guys to take a moment to look at these statistics. So over 57% of the population demographic.
You don't have to get that close to the mic. It'll pick up. So you're good. Just relax.
57% of the students, but they make up 83% of the total discipline referrals. 73% of the black students did not meet reading benchmark. 85% did not meet math benchmark. And I want you guys to take a moment, because there's people behind these numbers. They're not just statistics. And this is happening on the day-to-day. I want you guys to all save the date. If you have a pen, please save the date for January 15th. We're going to have a state of the emergency success of black children. And this is centered and based around the new policy that you guys all passed, which is called House Bill 2016, the African American Success Plan. We're also going to be presenting later this afternoon before their advisory committee. But we're going to have a town hall at Boise Elementary School, basically to talk about the type of success plan that we could have for the African American students at this particular school. Also, save the date for the next 7th annual Teacher with Purpose Conference. That's going to be held again at Park Rose Middle School. We're going to have keynote speakers, Dr. Gloria Lassavillans, Tim Wise, and we're also going to have a number of national speakers and presenters that's going to be presenting. Now, let's get to the work. So Teacher with Purpose Conference. I started the Teacher with Purpose Conference in 2001 as a graduate student at Portland State University. During that time, it was a lot of protest that was happening within the community around the achievement gap. At that time, I was working with some student groups at Portland State, and we decided we wanted to have some type of action base. So we came together and we said, hey, let's come up with a conference and bring in experts around culturally relevant pedagogy and practice that can train teachers, teach administrators how to make their practice better. We were pretty successful. We brought in national speakers. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Bob Moses, a great civil rights icon. He was a keynote speaker, and we were able to draw over 150 educators during that time. I went into the classroom and became a teacher and began to teach with a purpose, so I wasn't able to have the time to be able to continue the conference. I started the conference back in 2011 as a 10-year anniversary, and we had a total of 11 teachers who attended that conference. 2012, I started the conference back again. We had a total of 15 teachers. And I was like, you know what? I need to step back because this work is too important and we need a greater number of educators attending this conference so we can help them better their practice. So I decided to take a leave of absence and I focused my attention on growing the conference, and we went from 15 people to a total of 200 people in 2013. 2014, it grew to a total of 350 educators across the state, and this year it has grown to over 500 educators across the state. And I thank you again, Senator Roblin and Representative Doherty, for attending the conference this year, and hopefully more of you guys can attend next year. The goal of the conference is to activate equity-focused policy. Oregon is known for passing a lot of equity policy. However, the policy looks really nice on the shelf, but we need to focus on implementation of these particular equity policies. And that's what the Teach for a Purpose is driven to do. We also support and inspire leadership for culturally relevant pedagogy institutions and practices. And we also developed a network. So now we have a total network of educators across the state who are all wanting this type of work. They attend the conference because they want to better their practice. They attend this conference because they want to become better educators. And they want to be able to know how to better relate to their students across the board, across culturally backgrounds. So the annual Teacher with Purpose Conference, it educates and inspires and informs teachers and administrators, parents, students, and community organizers in Oregon and across the nation about the importance of culturally relevant pedagogy and practice. We were able to be the grant recipients of the grant that you guys all was able to funnel out through the House Bill 3233. And we were grant recipients, so we created the Teacher with Purpose Leadership Institute. What we did was we partnered with a total of 7 school districts, and they created leadership teams. The leadership teams made up of the superintendent. If the superintendent was not able to make it, it was another person from the district level leadership who attended these particular sessions. We also had a principal, a teacher, and a student, and also parents who made up their particular district team. And what we did was we looked at all the different equity policies that Oregon has. For example, Senate Bill 103, which is the multicultural education bill that was passed in 1999. There's a number of equity bills that we looked at, we analyzed, and we took those bills and we had them take their own equity policies and align their equity policies with our particular laws that we have in place. And to basically analyze and assess and see if we are in some type of compliance with these particular laws. Because again, the laws look pretty on paper, but we need to start figuring out and having a conversation how we can implement them effectively within the classroom. So the Leadership Institute, through the help of ODE and the grant funds that you guys helped to funnel through, we were able to increase the knowledge of Oregon equity laws. A lot of superintendents did not know about Senate Bill 103. A lot of superintendents do not know about House Bill 2016. A lot of superintendents do not have a lot of knowledge about these particular laws that you guys are passing. So we were able, number one, to increase the knowledge base about these particular laws, and then after we increased the knowledge base, we were able to assess their own equity policies and connect it to the particular laws. This work is extremely important. Policy into practice. What we're finding is that through all these different equity policies, there's no accountability. So, ODE submitted the Oregon Equity Access to Educator Plan, which was influenced by our U.S. Secretary of Education, who was asking state agencies to come up with some type of plan of how you are bringing about culturally relevant pedagogy and practice and how you are able to have excellent educators across the board. What Oregon, the ODE identified, they identified several gaps. One of the gaps was the recruitment and retainment of educators. One of the gaps also was the belief gap, inadequate teacher preparation and attracting educators in rural and remote districts. But I want you guys to focus right now on the belief gap. This is what our Oregon Education Department identified as one of the high needs, a belief gap. What that is, basically, as a teacher, I have to believe in my students. I have to have a high expectations in my students. I have to believe, no matter what type of background they come from, I still have to have a high expectation and a belief in them that they can learn. And what we found is that the belief gap is extremely low. A lot of educators do not believe, I have that type of belief that all their students can learn and be effective. What we want to do is we want to help you all and help our state come out with a systematic process to ensure all agencies are following the same language of culturally relevant pedagogy and practice. Because across the board, if you ask this person, this person, this person, they all have different definitions. I want to work with you all to be able to come with a common language that we all can streamline and align with our own equity policies that we have. Take a look here. We have House Bill 3232-3233, which was the strategic funds that we were able to have, which was we were able to start the institute. We have Senate Bill 290, which is the teacher evaluation. The teacher evaluation law that you guys just passed has no equity lens attached to it. So if we're evaluating teachers, how are we going to evaluate them on their culturally relevant pedagogy and practice? And that's what we want to be able to help you guys with. Senate Bill 103, Multicultural Education. We have Senate Bill 739, which is the Multicultural Perspective in Oregon Studies. We have the House Bill 2192, which deals with the disproportion of discipline. We have House Bill 3375, which is able to bring more diverse teachers into Oregon. All of these are great policies. So what are we going to do about it? So I'm asking you that you help us continue our funding so we can be able to continue to work with these school districts to increase the knowledge of these particular equity laws and other laws that we have in place, put an equity lens behind it, put a culturally relevant pedagogy, language, and lens behind it, and let us continue to do our work because all of a sudden the funding was cut. I personally took a resign to be able to focus on this work, thinking that these funds are going to be renewed. No, that's not the case. Okay? So now, I still have my teacher license. I'm never going to lose that. I'm never going to give that away. But I'm here before you pushing this work with no funding. I have my son here because I started out. This is real for me because he actually, my kids attend a school, a low-performing school, attends a school that does not practice culturally relevant pedagogy in practice. So this is real to me. And he wanted to come and he wanted to say a few words. After we testify and after we say our words, we have a few educators, teachers, who are in the trenches, who are classroom teachers now, who wants to come and testify and be able to share with you their learning and how they've become empowered through the Teaching with Purpose Conference and through the trainings that we're providing. And then we're going to open up for questions, and hopefully you guys have a lot of questions to be able to ask us so we can be able to have a good dialogue. Mr. Aaron, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Aaron Cruz. I want to be an astronaut, but the work at my school is easy. My dad gives me hard work at home. But I want harder work at school. The books my teacher reads don't have black faces in the books that looks like me. Can you change this?
Thank you.
So hopefully that's the question that you guys can answer. At this time, we're going to have our educators come and say a few words, and we're going to come back and answer questions. Thank you. Just for a moment, let's go sit up there.
Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin, thank you so much for having us here. Members of the committee, thank you. I've submitted a written testimony, but I kind of wish to speak to you a little bit more directly today. I have been incredibly blessed.
Be sure and identify yourself. Identify yourself. You need
My name is Kevin Walker. I'm a sixth grade teacher at Fabian School in Northeast Portland.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been really blessed with a stable home, good upbringing, and a multitude of privileges. But a lot of my students, many of my 21 students at Fabian School in Northeast Portland, they do not have the same stable upbringing and privileges that I've had in my life. Currently in this state, 8% of the state teachers are teachers of color. 17% of the administrators are people of color, yet 36% of our student population are students of color and growing. And this is from the Oregon Department of Education report card, our state report, 2014-2015. As educators, we are systematically failing students of color. Almost twice as many black and Latino students drop out versus their white counterparts. In order to reach all students, we as a teaching force need relevant professional development to effectively reach all students. White teachers need to know how to be cultural brokers and culturally responsive in the classroom to raise all student achievement. The Teach with a Purpose Conference has equipped myself, along with many other educators, with tools to become culturally responsive teachers. Attending this event comes out of my home budget. I pay for this because I care about the outcomes of every student in my classroom and in order to do my job effectively. The Teach with a Purpose Conference provides this professional development that we can use in the classroom to ensure lower disparity rates between students of color and their counterparts. Culturally responsive teaching works. How many more students need to drop out or feel unsuccessful, or give up, before we can all agree that the way we are approaching educating our students of color, it just isn't working? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and Chair Roblin. It's nice to see you again, Chair Doherty. My name is Amy Havens, and you came and visited my classroom last year at Tuolumne Middle School. I would like to talk to you guys about being intentional in equity work. I intentionally decided to leave 16 years of experience in the Tiger-Tualatin School District to go work at Boise Elementary, Boise Elliott, so I could work with an underachieving school in a different demographics. I now have over 93% students of color in my fourth grade classroom. And I would like to note that we have been residing under this assumption that we're doing equity work all throughout the state. But I would also like to note that the data, the discipline data, the achievement data is not changing. So we need to look at what we're doing because it's not working. About 9 years ago, I started my equity journey in the Tiger-Tualatin School District. And I am here to say that not only does the data show that the change isn't happening, but the students' experiences in our schools across the state of Oregon, they're not changing. We need to do something different, and we need to be intentional about how we look at it. The Teaching with Purpose conference is that something different. After attending the conference, I had an increased enthusiasm for the work that I have been in. I appreciated that there were people there besides teachers. There was administrators there. There were lawmakers there. There were community members. And I feel that we need this sense of collaboration among all of us to create the change that our students of color so desperately need. I also really appreciated the keynote speakers. There were well-published, highly recognized people in the world of equity that were presenting at the conference. Also, being a white ally in this work, you would think that I have a great amount of peers that I can relate to and get support from, but that hasn't been the case in my experience. I appreciated the conference giving me a group of educators that can become a support system. It really, really is encouraging when you look at equity work. Finally, my classroom was impacted immediately that Monday in regards to assessment. I created a framework for my students where kids could be more engaged in their education when they were given harder tasks. They showed more perseverance. And when you have fourth graders coming in stating, "Ms. Havens, is today the post-assessment day?" excitedly, then you know that you're on the right track. I would like to end with two stories that students in my classroom shared with me. These are fourth graders again. A student expressed to me that his mom was nervous about driving to Gresham to see family because of the KKK notes that were being left on vehicles. Another student expressed the sorrow that was happening in her home because of a shooting that happened just blocks from our school was her cousin. And although my first inclination is to acknowledge that in my whiteness, these students of color are able to explain to me the trauma that they endure on a daily basis, I get such a sense of urgency to also acknowledge that we need to do better, that we need to do better to understand the worlds of these students, and that most importantly, I have to do the best I can do at educating them, the best I can with high expectations, so when they leave me, they're very competitive with their white counterparts, because right now that's not happening in our state. So I would ask you, Chair and Representatives, to be intentional with how you support funding for equity work. How do you allocate it? What resources do you support? And looking at conferences like Teaching with Purpose so we can make a difference. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. My name is Nadja Swalem. I'm a teacher at Centennial Park School in the Centennial School District. I teach high school language arts. I grew up in East Multnomah County, which was an extremely different place in the 1980s than it is today. My neighborhood was so white that me, like the fairest Arab in my family, was one of the only people of color in my school. I'm now a teacher in the Centennial School District, which is one of the East County schools whose student population is becoming increasingly more diverse, while the population of teachers remains predominantly white. While I have attended numerous conferences and taken culturally responsive teaching courses in my grad program previously, Teaching with Purpose focuses directly on you, your practice, and the empowerment of students of color. More than a conversation about race, Teaching with a Purpose is a call to action. It begs the question, how can we as educators meet students of color where they truly are, in their own schools and in their own neighborhoods? Because so often, we are looking outside of those areas to teach them in other places. So now, as a result of that, in my elective writing class, students are currently working on a guidebook to Portland landmarks.
we've been traveling around Portland and checking kind of a lot of places out, but what I realized after seeing Dr. Christopher Emden speak is that we need to focus on our community at hand. I realized that it was important to honor where students come from, and so we're now currently working on a local guide to restaurants within our community. As a first-generation Palestinian, I never saw myself in teachers, and I know that my students rarely see themselves in me. While I understand the first-generation experience, my skin color allows me privileges that many of my students will never experience. So I'm transparent with my students about this fact, and Teaching with a Purpose reminded me that my job is to inspire, teach, and create opportunities rather than hit students over the head with my white guilt. I will never truly understand what it is to walk in their shoes, but I can help guide them on a path of their choosing. And my job as an educator is to help students understand that their power is not only in education, but in telling their own truth. My colleague and I, who attended the conference with me, we were so inspired, and like I've already mentioned him once, we were so inspired by Dr. Christopher Emden that we brought a video of him and one of his lectures back to our school as part of our equity work, and we shared it as an in-service to start speaking about the ideas of reality pedagogy. We've taken his ideas to heart, and one of the things that he preaches is bringing your students in and allowing them to teach the class in a particular way, and that's something that we are planning on doing as well. Specifically also, S. Renee Mitchell's poetry session has also inspired our work, and we now begin our first period language arts classes by ciphering up and sharing in circles. And by doing so, we've created a stronger classroom community where students are more comfortable speaking from the heart, even when the subject matter is difficult. Teaching with Purpose impacted me in a way that I never expected. It changed the way that I think about and advocate for students, and not just students of color, but all students. Attending the conference helped me to realize how traumatized students are by our educational system. And while I knew our system was flawed, I didn't understand that it was not created truly for the betterment of people. And it's not about leveling the playing field. The playing field may never be level, but through transparency, discussion, and thoughtful, culturally responsive teaching, we as educators can work toward truly equitable practice. And I urge you to make it possible for more teachers to actually do this work and actually get the opportunity to go to this conference, because it has done really amazing things for the people who have been there and for the students. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions for this group? No, you're good.
You're good. So, we would like to be your reporting agency. We want to report to you guys through town halls. We can come to Salem to be able to report on how culturally relevant pedagogy and practice is streamlining through the policies that you guys all pass. As you can see, the conference report that was just passed out to you, we have a total of 85% of teachers who attend the conference, 11% principals, 1% superintendents. We want to increase that number of superintendents. So we want to really focus on leadership. And we have a great opportunity because I have a lot of good relationships with COSA. I have a lot of relationships with the teacher unions. So we can leverage all these different relationships and be able to provide these different types of trainings to administration and let it trickle down all the way down to educators who we are majorly attracting, but we want to be able to attract those upper administration as well. So if you guys have any questions at this time, we can.
Any questions? I do want to say, if you haven't gone, I think it is important for us to attend the conference. It was really good to hear the different keynote people at the beginning. I would love to have spent the whole day, but I had some other requirements. And there were a few students. There was one young lady in particular who gave a recitation. It reminded me, my son was in debate, and there are different categories in debate, and she gave a speech which everyone should hear, and I couldn't do justice to it if I wanted to, but it really helps people consider where they come from in the context of this person explaining where she came from, and every educator should see it, because I think it was it really put a light on some things that would help people be more receptive to understanding why it's important to have culturally responsive pedagogy. And so I thank you very much for that. Lou?
Thank you, Chair. Hello again. We correspond on a regular basis, text messages, et cetera. But there's a real key element here that I think is important. We have had for 30 years one equity education bill or another come through this body. We have the real question is how what we do in terms of the next steps, taking the action, getting people there. You both have managed to bring folks together, and we need to have more folks coming together to do this kind of work. So I really want to thank you for that. It's also a matter of supporting it. We tend to do a short-term support, believing that somehow we've supported it and we don't need to do anything more. These two programs have been very, really effective, but they need to continue. Mm-hmm. So if we can find a way to do that, that's what we really need to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. And I was going to say, Aaron, I couldn't be an astronaut when I was younger because girls couldn't be astronauts. So things have changed, and I know they're all going to change for you, too.
Thank you.
Astronaut.
That's right.
In the 90s, we were concerned when I was on the school board about increasing the pool of people of color that came into education. And is there anybody in the state increasing whose job it is to increase the number of candidates?
Sure. Not just one person. There's a team of folks that are working on just that, trying to make sure that we are, in fact, increasing. Those are the statistics and a group that meets, I think our next meeting is next week, as I recall, on a regular basis to not only look at the numbers, but also see how well we're doing and where we're not doing well. We are doing well. We're doing better because of a request to in increasing the number of administrators, minority administrators, but in terms of teachers, we continue to fail to attract minority teachers and keep them. It's not just attracting, but it's actually keeping them in the profession. That's one of the issues, and that issue is both related to minority, the minority status, but also just simply teachers. Mm-hmm. We're having problems keeping teachers because of a number of things that you and I don't want to go into right now. This attempts to say we already have people who are there ready to work. They just need the support. These two programs provide that support.
And I remember your bill, right, changing the language on that.
Okay. Can I make a comment regarding that?
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think that's extremely important. And one of the things I want you guys to really understand is that culturally relevant pedagogy and practice is just not for white educators.
Right.
It's for everybody. It's because we all have to have that type of lens and be able to relate. It's the teaching on purpose is a teaching practice, and it's based around three principles: having high expectations, building relationships, and then also providing culturally relevant materials within your classroom. So it's based around those three principles. So yes, we do need to increase the number of teachers of color into the classroom, but at the same time, that's not going to make the total difference because through my experience, we all need this type of training.
And Representative McLean.
Oh, I simply wanted to thank all of you for being here today, and I appreciated your presentations and also the teachers. And really, I support your goals and I support your sentiment. And I also support the professional standards that you set today for how we support, and the comment that you just made goes directly to that. I have been very fortunate to be able to teach speech and debate 42 years in the state, and we do a lot of the things that you describe as being good practices. But I had a young man who came as a as a 9-year-old here to this country as an undocumented student. And he just, as a 19-year-old going to PCC, gave a TED Talk yesterday on immigration and wanting the support, some of the same support issues for young people who are here in Oregon for a number of different reasons with different backgrounds and different experiences and different family issues and situations. And how do you support that student as they're trying to get to be the first generation of their family to go to college? And so those high expectations, those standards, I think, are very important. This sounds like a really interesting program, and I'm going to try to be at the next conference.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hello. Well, last comment.
Last comment. Aaron, I wanted to be an astronaut as well. In fact, I got that close. I was one of the top 100 journalists in space, and then we had an accident. So I didn't get a chance to go up, but I still want to go to space, and I still think you
not
can
me.
Go to...
No. I get queasy on my second floor landing.
So, again, thank you for being here. Thank you for the efforts you put into the conference, and thank you for what Eastern Oregon is doing. So, with that, we're going to end this informational hearing, and the Senate is going to take a recess and reconvene in Hearing Room B.
Education. Thank you all very much for being here this morning. Okay, we've got two informational hearings, and the first one we're going to start out with is the Oregon Association of Student Councils. So we're going to open up an informational hearing on from the OASC group.
Oh,
so if the ladies would like to come up.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leah Olson, and I am a senior here this year at Westland High School. I would first like to thank you for your time today. We are students from the Oregon Association of Student Councils, also known as OASC Capital Ambassadors Program. OASC is an organization made up of student leaders, and the Capital Ambassadors Program within OASC is made up of students interested in government and politics.
And you don't have to be so close to the microphone. It'll pick
okay.
you up, so you can relax. And
perfect.
Thank you.
We are here today to share our perspectives and personal experiences with various educational issues. Many stakeholders are at the table when education decisions are being made. Teachers, parents, school administrators, nonprofits, and business groups. But where is the seat at this table for students? I quickly found student opinion is underrepresented in our state government. This helped to motivate me to find out what my peers were thinking. I then began to work on a statewide survey to gauge student data on smarter balance testing, Common Core learning standards, and school funding within Oregon. I was able to administer such a survey through OASC to over 1,200 of my peers who are student leaders at their high school at their annual fall conference. The findings are what I am presenting to you today. The completed survey was reviewed and edited with help of a professional pollster. The survey was administered with several precautions and safeguards to ensure that the data is statistically significant for high school leadership students statewide. This data can be used to gauge the opinions of leadership students on the major educational issues in our state. I believe leadership students are a particularly valuable population to survey because they are directly responsible for representing their peers. Personally, I believe concepts tested by the Smarter Balance test more accurately gauge the knowledge of students compared to OAKS testing. I have mixed feelings about the administration and instructive process of the test. While I have my own set of opinions about SBAC, I want to present to you the collective opinions of my peers because the data shows something needs to change. 69% of the students surveyed who took the Smarter Balance test did not think it was a good measure of what they should be expected to learn in school. 78% of students who have not yet taken the test received negative feedback from other students and teachers. This shows a population of students who are frustrated and dissatisfied. Student opinion of the test is crucial if you hope to obtain accurate results from the test. The data shows that 33% of the students surveyed, so a third of the students surveyed, put in little to no effort while taking the test. This means that the data collected from students' test scores may not be an accurate representation of their knowledge, and the results may be misleading. When looking at Common Core learning standards, 56% of students surveyed disagreed these are the skills students should have when they graduate from high school. This means over half of our leadership students do not approve of the standards educators are given to teach them. On the topic of school funding, 71% of students surveyed do not think Oregon schools are adequately funded. I gave students a scale of 1 to 6 for this question on the survey, and a quarter answered with a 1, the lowest possible rating. Regardless of your opinion on the validity or value of SBAC and Common Core, the data shows there is a significant disconnect between policymakers on the state and federal level and students. It is possible that the problem is a substantive one, that the tests and the standards themselves are flawed. It is also possible that students have not been adequately informed about the content and value of SBAC and Common Core. Either way, I believe that students take cues from their leaders. The issue of testing and education standards are becoming increasingly divisive, with disagreements between the federal and state governments, state government and school districts and parents. The tension has left students with an accumulation of negativity, which makes it very difficult for them to succeed academically. I hope this information has been valuable to you, and I am happy to answer any questions and provide additional information.
Thank you. Okay, Leah, I think we'll wait till everyone's done, and then we'll ask questions of the panel.
Great.
Okay.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Grace Didway, and I am a sophomore at Oregon City High School. Thank you for allowing me time to share my thoughts with you today. As a student, I can tell you firsthand that our schools are in desperate need of your help. Throughout my years in public education, I have watched 3 out of the 10 elementary schools in my district close. Many staff members were laid off, and young students were uprooted from their communities. The school calendar has been cut 2 to 15 days for 7 of the 11 years I've been a student. That means that as a sophomore, I have only had 4 full school years. Keep in mind that Oregon has one of the shortest school years in the nation, even with a full calendar. Due to these cuts, I have lost many hours of instructional time and educational opportunities. But when taking AP exams, my performance is still being compared to students around the country who have had more instruction. Having Oregon students underprepared for crucial exams puts us at a significant disadvantage when applying for merit scholarships and college admission. In order to balance the budget, my class sizes have increased dramatically. Each year, my classes feel more and more impersonal. I have watched my teachers struggle under the demands of so many students and receive less feedback on my essays and assignments. Though the teachers in my life have made many personal sacrifices and adjustments to go the extra mile for their students, I feel as though they are not adequately compensated. They have often spent money out of their own pocket to enhance our learning environment. To achieve our full potential, we as students need individualized attention. One algebra teacher with a class of 37 students, no matter how skilled or dedicated, cannot meet the needs of every student in a class period. Oregon has a goal of a 100% graduation rate by the year 2025, and in order to achieve that goal, we must invest in it. We must invest in our schools, but also in important social services for children and families to address the barriers that keep them from accessing that education. Asking students to complete homework for their English class is unreasonable when their basic needs have not been met. Until we can assure that all students will have a roof over their head, food security, and a stable home environment, we cannot expect to achieve our dream of success for all. Let's make Oregon a great place to be a kid. Thank you for your time and consideration. Thank you. Chair Doherty and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rachel Christensen, and I'm a junior at Clatskanie High School. Thank you for the opportunity to stand before you and speak about something that directly affects my future. My school's in the northwest region of the state, nestled in timber-heavy country with a combined student body of less than 400 students. I asked my teachers and peers what they thought was the biggest problem with our current education system. The responses were numerous, but one theme stuck: funding. Funding affects our class sizes. Funding affects the dated materials in the classroom. Funding affects one-on-one learning time. These problems not only affect K through 12, but also influence the success rate of students moving into college and beyond. Education Week Research Center
ranked Oregon 41 out of the 50 states for education achievement and standards in 2014. This not only shocks me, but makes me less proud to be an Oregonian. In my school, our ADM, or average daily membership, is around 367 students. According to the United States Census Bureau's most recent data, the state average for federal, state, and local funding per student in Oregon is approximately $9,543. This may seem like a lot of money to the average high school student, but in the school system, it is considerably lower than our country's average. Not only is this not enough to help with the problems we have educating our students, each of our 16 teachers are having to work with over 160 students with only one working preparation period. Hearing about this in the Capitol is very different than living with it. I love the teachers and friends I've made in my school, but not having a home economics class, personal finance, or even adequate advanced placement courses has prompted parents to remove their kids from our district. These issues are detrimental to students' futures and also to those who will never reach their full potential in primary or high school. I don't feel prepared for my next level of education. I don't feel that I have learned all the important core subjects that I need to excel in a college setting. Not being able to have my questions answered because there are 35 other students also raising their hands in class presents a challenging learning environment. When I have friends that struggle with the basics of reading because no one took the time to sit down with them and help them at a young age, makes me wonder how successful their futures will be. Unfortunately, our story in Kladskanai is not unique in this sense, and there are many other public schools that are having these same issues. I am grateful for this opportunity to represent my school, my peers, and myself. I know that you all on the Education Committee are aware of these problems and are committed to making Oregon a great place to learn and grow, and I'm thankful for that. I wanted to share my short but small town story and give a view into what it is really like to live and learn in a lower to middle class industrial town. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, just want to put the microphone there. Perfect. Okay. Actually, that's even close enough.
Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Julissa Marquez, and I'm a senior at the Dalles High School. When I first moved to the Dalles, Oregon in third grade, I was put into a school that was about one-third of the size of my old school in California. My parents said that the change would be good for my brothers and I, with less violence and smaller class sizes than Californian schools did. They were right. I quickly learned that I was a year ahead of my peers and easily aced my classes, but I never questioned it. Years later, my brother was telling me stories of how high school used to have interactive programs like welding and culinary arts, and mentioned an open campus. Not too long after, one of my brothers dropped out, and I didn't understand why. Until recently. Last year, only 64% of the Dalles High School students graduated on time, landing the school eighth from the bottom out of about 120 Oregon high schools. Walking into my freshman year of high school, I expected to have the same opportunities as my brothers did. I soon learned that because of budget cuts, they had to remove classes like welding and culinary arts from the high school. We didn't have a pool or a football field. We didn't have enough books to go around or enough lockers. Our cafeteria is as big as a classroom, which is why we have an open campus. I walked down my hallway dying of heat because we simply don't have enough money for air conditioning. My school was falling apart. We closed our auditorium down for almost a year because of falling tiles and asbestos, only to learn that it was fixed with a little bit of tape. A little over a year ago, our local hospital teamed up with my school and raised us a great deal of money. All of our students were eager to know where the funding was going to. Months later, we found out that all of the funding was going to our gym and weight room. We all felt crushed and robbed because instead of having brand new books or even a fan for each room, we now have new equipment in our weight room, cardio machines, a new paint job in our gym, and some paid trainers. Even after a significant fundraising campaign, we still don't have enough money. The Dalles High School went through some development, not just to understand why our school is less successful than others, but to begin to fix the problem. The administration has changed the class schedule every year, our mascot, our name, and even changed semesters to trimesters. We began to realize that there were multiple factors that separated us from different schools, especially suburban and urban schools, and overall created an environment that no student desired. The students of the Dalles High School recognize that our school needs improvement in multiple means, but we believe we need a new approach in doing so, starting with a helping hand. I hope that as you and your colleagues are making decisions about education and funding levels, that you keep in mind of the smaller and rural schools that are struggling to provide even basic opportunities to their students. Thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative McLean.
Well, I want to thank you for starting with a factual base for your presentations, because I think we need both the facts and we also need your personal involvement and what you believe are the values that you have both for your own education and also for the education of the other students in your school districts. And I want to thank you for that. And did you give all of your testimony so it can be put on OLIS for us?
Yes, it's there.
There are 12 letters on
okay,
OLIS
so
from other students.
Too. Everybody who presented turned that in, correct? Because
yes.
I haven't had a chance to read all of it yet.
Yeah.
I just want, the only question that I would have, and that is, did in your student council fall conference, did you guys start talking about solutions to money? Did you start talking about some of the ideas that you have or your family has or your parent has or your community has? You know, the community has as far as ideas that could help us with the solution and the budget issues?
It is possible that there were conversations. We had different breakout sessions, so it's possible that those conversations did occur, although I don't have personal knowledge of them occurring. Through the new Capital Ambassadors Program, we're hoping to start pooling more information, such as the survey that was given out to the OASC students, and so that might come in the next few years.
That's
possibly.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you all. The letters are just absolutely terrific. The comments are terrific. I want to go back to something, though, that you started off with. In 1997, a couple sophomores came forward to the Portland School Board meeting, and they said, we don't have any student representation. What are we doing? They began what they call the Superintendent Student Advisory Council for the Portland Schools. And about a year and a half after that began, they came up with another idea, which was to put a student on each school board. They officially can't vote. Their vote can't be registered as a legal vote, because you have to be on the school board in another way. But they do have a student representative on the Portland School Board. And I think on Albany?
Tiger does. Tiger. Many of them.
And David Douglas does.
Forest Grove does. As
it
well.
I would encourage you to encourage the adults to say, look, you really do need to know what we're thinking, how we're dealing with things on a regular basis. Get those folks there, because you make a huge difference. Just understanding what's taking place, the number of kids in a classroom, the impact that has, the concern about the DALs is something that should be brought forward as strongly as possible, because you need to know what you're going to concentrate on in the schools. And you are there. You're there every day. I can't say enough on how pleased I am with what you presented. It was just outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. Thank you.
Okay, great. Representative Peluso.
And I'd just be curious to hear from each of you what your future goals are.
I want to attend Willamette University. I applied last Sunday. And
Excellent idea.
And I want to study politics. I'm potentially thinking about getting a master's in education. I'm thinking about minoring in possibly philosophy, history, or psychology. And I want to end up here.
Excellent. Very good.
I am also interested in Willamette and Georgetown as well. Hopefully a political science major and a minor in women's studies.
I'm a junior, so I'm not really deeply considering any colleges yet, but I would like to be involved in politics and also business and marketing. That's one of my main focuses.
Mm-hmm. My number one choice is PSCU, and I want to study architecture and graphic design.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck with it all.
Yes. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for your comments about SBAC and Common Core. I got an earful for my grandchildren, which got me motivated to attempt to do things about that in the last session. We were partially successful, but I think we have a long ways to go. So thank you, and I sympathize. Also, as one who has put two children through Willamette, pray for your parents.
I'm counting on the scholarships. That's
yeah. And your parents' retirement accounts, is that what you're saying? Any other questions? Representative Rudin.
Do any of your schools have career technical student organizations, Skills USA, DECA, FBLA, any of those?
Oregon City High School has DECA, yes.
Okay. Any of the others?
At Westland, we might have DECA, but the other ones I'm not familiar of.
Yeah. Okay. I know Tualatin has SELA and, mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final comment. I had an opportunity here in the last year to buy a home that was constructed by CTE and STEM students up here in Salem, and it's been a great experience. So I hope there are more opportunities like that as well.
Great, thank you very much. And we also have some, and we thank you for speaking here, but we also have other students from the Student Council. If you guys would like to stand up so at least we can know who's here from the Student Council
wow.
Association.
Welcome.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. And welcome to your state capital. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much. Okay, with that, we close the informational hearing from the Oregon Association of Student Councils and open up a public hearing or an informational hearing on Innovate Oregon. And just a little background, actually, Representative Reardon suggested that we invite the panel back. He was in the higher ed and workforce, if you want to introduce that.
I didn't know I was going to get this opportunity to introduce. We actually had coffee quite a while ago, and Thompson mentioned a number of things in which he was able to bring industry in and start kind of working in to really drive and make people more aware of the innovation process and how business and educators and students can work together to do some really innovative things. And he tells the story much better than I do, but it's getting some hands-on projects that are going, and schools have been pretty receptive, so I think it's some great opportunities out there. I'll let you tell the story, though.
Welcome, Mr.
Thank you for coming up.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you, Representative Reardon, and good morning, Chair Doherty and the rest of the board. My name is Thompson Morrison. I'm with Innovate Oregon. And what I would like to do this morning is myself and with Jamie first, principal of Dayton School District, is just tell a little story about what we've been doing with Innovate Oregon and how we came to be and where we're going, and just to bring you all into the storyline that we've been helping to create here within Oregon. So, let me just see how this will work. So, Innovate Oregon came out of an initiative out of the Technology Association of Oregon. The Technology Association of Oregon is our organization that represents our technology-based companies. Not just software, not just hardware, any technology-enabled company, which is pretty much any company now in the marketplace. And we set about ourselves about 6 years ago with a question. How could we as an organization become a catalyst for an economic renaissance here in Oregon, and how could we help create a mecca of innovation? So we set about to do that. And as we did that, we began to realize that the issue that we had around talent was one which fundamentally boiled down to how do we prepare our students with the creative problem-solving skills that they need to be, that we need in our companies. Because regardless of what their employment path is, these are the core skills that are needed to drive our economy. Now, when we started this process about 8 years ago, Oregon was ranked 45th in the state in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation, 45th. Just a few months ago, the study was done again by the University of Nebraska, and we are now ranked 5th. Huge transformation that's happened in our economy. We are now seen from a backwater to being one of the most innovative economies in the entire country. We are driving economic growth throughout the whole region. There is, however, one challenge. We don't have talent. We don't have the employees that we need to continue to grow our companies. It is a desperate situation. It's a situation that we've been facing and talking about. We have to spend excessive amount of money to import people from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. It's a dire crisis. But this is not just our problem within the technology sphere. Talk to any manufacturer, anybody within the industry, and they will say they have the same problem. We do not have the talent. And So the fundamental aspect, when you ask, when you talk about, what do you mean if you don't have the talent? It boils down to this. Do we have not only the skill sets, but more importantly, the mindsets of creative problem solvers? Is that really what we are? Is that really the talent that we have that can come in and say, I don't know how to solve the problem, but I will solve it for you, and have the ability to go and solve that problem? Because we are in a very dynamic economic situation, and we need that. Now, here in Oregon, we all know the data. We all know that we are oftentimes referred to as the Mississippi of the West in terms of our educational system. However, we rank below Mississippi. In terms of our graduation rates, we also have an aspiration goal of 40-40-20. But let's be honest. It's a long, long road to achieve 40-40-20. When you look at the data looks at, we took a cohort. This came out of the Oregon Business Council working with ODE data. Looked at the cohort from 2006 through 2014. What happened to them as they went through the system? And we found that only a quarter actually received any type of achievement, post-secondary achievement. Our aspiration is 100% graduation rate and 80% having some type of post-secondary. We are a long way away from that right now. This is the reality. Now, what happens in business, in an innovation-based economy, is that if you try to play catch-up, you will fail. Because the market is so dynamic that the market moves faster than you move. The only way to achieve success is to leapfrog. We cannot play catch-up. Iowa is so far ahead of us in terms of graduation rates, it's not even funny, they're at 90%. If we just try to incrementally change the dials of our existing process, it won't work. So we then said, how do we, as an industry, begin to co-create and engage with our educators to reimagine the possible? And that's what we set about to do. 3 years ago, we started up in Franklin High School. We came into this high school, and we began to listen. And when we began to listen, we found out that not only did we have a crisis where we didn't have the talent, and not only did the system have a crisis that we didn't have the capacity to teach the skill sets of the 21st century, but there was a more important crisis, and that was the crisis of the students. They didn't even know why they were there. Mm-hmm. It's a crisis of relevancy. Why are we here? And if we don't begin to address that issue of relevancy, that is the root cause. Everything else is a symptom. That's the root cause. So we began to say, okay, students, what do you passionately care about? What do you want to change? And how can we walk alongside you and make a difference? So we spun up an Innovation Academy at Franklin High School. We began to work all summer long, develop 7 prototypes and deliver those working with industry. And the teachers would walk in on those Saturday mornings in Franklin High School and say, what's going on in here? We're solving problems. The kids were engaged, they were solving problems, and they were learning really fast. We then took that into an after-school program, continued that not only at Franklin, Madison, 3 other schools. By the following year, Franklin High School, which had no computer science, not even any administration support around computer science, not a single teacher who knew anything about computer science, a year later, they had 240 kids studying computer science in 8 classes. Why? Because the kid says they want it, they forecast it, and one of my great guides in this process, a fellow by the name of Terrell Smith, down in Sherwood, he told me a story. He said, remember, Thompson, the money follows the kids. And you know what? It does. When the kids say we want to learn something, the system will begin to have to teach them. And that began to happen. But what we were challenged at one point, we said, that's fine. You're working with Portland. Portland's a very difficult animal. It's a 800-pound gorilla in Portland public school system. So one of the board members of the TAO said, well, what would happen if you took this concept into a rural community? A rural community which doesn't have a lot of assets. 2,500 folks in the school, about 2/3 living in poverty, about 1/3 being Hispanic. What would happen if you took that innovation culture into a rural community? And we said, I don't know. Let's try it. So we went down to Dayton, Oregon. A little over a year ago, We spun up an Innovation Academy down there, and they said, wow, this is amazing. What would happen, they asked, if we brought that into our school and made it a requirement for all of our schools to actually work in a sprint, solve problems, and create the design thinking and the skill sets needed for the 21st century. Now, one of the things I've learned is rural communities are really different than urban communities. I'm a city kid. Going down a rural community, you put an idea out there and say, they look in the eyes and say, let's do it. And they mean it. So that next fall, we actually spun up the first in-school innovation academy. Now, once you go into a school, it is a different storyline. You have all the reality of a school, which means you got the learning target, you got grading rubrics, you got all of the teaching requirements. But what happened down there is something that began to be magical and began to transform an entire district. And so what happened there is that we began to look at this culture, and we began to use our tool sets of understanding culture and passion. We developed what was called an innovation score. So we, every school that we're touching, because not only we're touching Dayton, we're working with the Yamhill Carleton, we're working with the Central, we're assigning an innovation score. What is the innovation culture of the school? Because it's really ultimately a culture issue. And when we began to look at that, we began to recognize that the perception of the innovation culture changed as a student went through their school. And this was not unique to Dayton. That as students went through it, they began to see it as a less creative, less challenging environment for them. And we began to say, oh, this is the core issue we need to address, is how do we begin to affect the perception and the environment, the educational ecosystem of that environment. So we asked the students, you have to, what we just heard was the students' voice here, and this is very critical. You have to start with the students. We are their servant leaders. Okay? Do they want to have these skill sets? These are not the skill sets of a minority. We used to have this idea that it was just those kids who wanted these skill sets. No, that's not the case anymore. The vast majority want these skill sets. And the vast majority want to be a part of something that is bigger around innovation. We then ask the teachers, do you want to be a part of it? Is it important that here in Dayton that we create students, that we develop students who are creative problem solvers? There was not a single student, a single teacher who said no. They said, yes, this is absolutely what we need to do. And how well are we doing? And they said, basically, we're not doing all that well, but we've got to do better. And is it important that they learn the new skill sets? Again, the teacher says, absolutely. And of course, we asked the parents, is this important? And they said the same thing. There is no question that there isn't significant fundamental alignment of the fact that we need to reimagine how we are educating our kids in order to prepare them for the economy that they're going into. So what we did is we said, okay, let's reimagine what the experience of education looks like. I walk into a school, I would not survive a school day sitting for 8 hours having someone talk at me all day long. I couldn't do it. I don't think any of us could do it. And that's what we expect our kids to do. I walked into a classroom, and I'm not a teacher, but I have been running for over 20 years very dynamic, fast-growth companies. I said, let's teach the way that they are going to be learning once they leave here. Let's teach using Agile, which is an Agile development process, where you say, we are going to focus on purpose, we're going to create the tool sets of skills as we need them, and we're going to apply them as we need them. So we create what was called an Agile learning model. 3 days a week, they learn how to code. 2 days a week, they had to solve a problem in teams. Go. And what happened was dramatic. Moving from a traditional bell curve, where you have a couple of kids who are engaged and a couple of kids who are disruptors and everybody else, it's like a mound of jello you're trying to incrementally move forward into classrooms. Been there?
The former teachers are laughing.
Right. But what happened there was all of a sudden it turned into a team that had to deliver. And everybody was engaged and everybody was committed and it was electrifying. Now, Jamie had no idea what we're doing. She just said, go ahead, go do it. She walked in one of our classes. I spent about 5 minutes there and walked out. She turned to me later and said, I got it. She had never seen that before. Where kids who had been marginalized, who didn't feel engaged, were all of a sudden a part of a team committed to solve a problem that they cared about, and therefore they needed to learn those skills to solve that problem, and they were learning. So she challenged me and said, oh, that's great, but can you do that for math? I said, I don't know math. She said, okay, Trig, go. And so we sat down with a teacher. A teacher was terrified about this. And we said, well, let's run this same model in a math class. They were learning conic sections. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I don't even know what a conic section is. Okay? But I had to teach the kids conic sections in this new model. So I quickly looked around. I said, where are we going to teach conic sections? Khan Academy. Pulled down the Khan Academy unit. Said, 3 days a week, you guys are going to learn conic sections. So, here's the Khan Academy. Go. But 2 days a week, you got to solve a problem. And you have to solve a problem. And I asked, how do we find a problem that is compelling to students? So I sit on the STEM Investment Council. And I know all the educators have all been talking about you've got to contextualize math. So I said, well, how do you contextualize trig? And everybody looked at me blankly, like, wait a minute, how do you contextualize math? So finally I found someone over at ODE, Tom Thompson, and says, trusses. Found a truss manufacturer, brought him in. He had not been in a school building for 20 years, and I said, I need you here. But he says, I don't use geometry at trigonometry anymore because the computer does it all. I don't care. You're coming in, and we're going to go figure this out together. So we sat down with a teacher. The students were given a challenge. 1,000-square-foot vacation home. You've got to cost it out. Critical piece of the costing is your roof. You've got to figure out what that roof is going to cost. And in order to know that roof, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to support that roof. That roof is going to require trusses. That truss is going to require you to use your trig. 35 cents a linear foot, 8 and 10-foot lengths of lumber. Go. 2 days a week, they had to solve that problem. 3 weeks later, they had to present their solution back to the manufacturer, back to Richard. And he was shaking his head, going, kids these days. What he saw blew him away. The kids had developed 3D modeling of these trusses. They had designed, they'd built buildings, they had done all these. And they could explain what they did and why they did it. That was transformational for the teacher and for the school. So this is when we began to say, so Jamie had the idea, the concept to say, let's take this everywhere. Let's take this to English. Let's take this to social studies. Let's create a cohort of agile learners everywhere. And as we did that, and as we created an innovation council to guide this process, which includes students, parents, industry leaders, we have seen nothing short of a creative explosion in this small little high school in Dayton, Oregon. This includes the first in the state Innovation 101 class, which is bringing best practices around innovation mindsets, bringing practices from Google, SparkFun, and Lemelson and MIT. Into that. That's now, next year, going to be a required class for every student at Dayton. Building partnerships with the business community. Building a concept of an I3 center, where we are going to allow the students to actually take those ideas and build them. I3 stands for inspiration, innovation, and invention. Now, this was interesting. At one of the first Innovation Council meetings, there was a woman there who represents the CEO of an internet provider. Just brought fiber to Dayton High School. She said, huh, let's talk. Within 3 weeks, we put together an MOU. And in the MOU, she committed to turning Dayton into a gigabit city. The only other gigabit cities we have are down Monmouth and Independence and Sandy. Dayton is going to be spun up and online in 3 months as a gigabit city. We have less than 50 in the entire country. Okay. Not only that, but it has a revenue sharing plan that's going to actually generate revenue that comes back in to support the students in their I3 center, because the students are going to help co-market this to the entire community. And she's also committing that all the students who need to have service, internet service in their homes that can't afford it, will be provided it free of charge. It's a new storyline. It's a whole new storyline. So what happens then is that when you start getting the entire community together, people like IBM start showing up. And they say, can we be a part of the storyline? Sure enough, IBM, opening up the door, all the resources, all their mentors, all their platforms. You have also folks like PSU's business school saying, could we come down and teach entrepreneurship? Absolutely, as a model. So what's happened here is we're beginning to now replicate this. It's not only about that you build it, but the key of innovation is replication. Umatilla, we will hear in 3 weeks whether or not we get a $5 million grant from the federal government to take models of their best practices for after-school STEM Innovation Academy, apply it to Dayton, create a model that can be replicated throughout the whole state. Yamhill Carleton, spinning up their Innovation Council meeting. They are also on the track to do the I3. Central, down in Monmouth and Independence, and Baker. We are learning how to innovate. We are learning how to move fast. We are learning how to pivot. Because it's a culture of moving fast, and it's a culture of collaboration. So how do we do that? We continue not only to understand how to replicate, but we recognize that this is a larger issue around skills. So we are forming with the economic development groups in Yamhill County and McMinnville a new skills council that will allow us to work with industry to identify the core skills and align our career pathways within our schools to teach those skills. Because right now, each district creates their own career pathways, and they don't communicate together. They don't strategically leverage them and align them with the skills that are needed for the industries in their own hometown. And that's what we're doing. The first meeting's on the 3rd of December. We're also taking that model of what we're doing with Online Northwest, and we're turning Yamhill into a gigabit county. Online Northwest is committing to bring Amity and every other city in Yamhill on as a gigabit city. And we're developing statewide corporate support. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Jamie, who can kind of talk a little bit about boots on the ground and what the experience has been for her as a principal shepherding the culture change within a school, a high school, in a rural community.
Thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to share.
You can identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jamie Fluke.
And you can just sit back.
Sit back. Okay.
Just sit back and relax.
Jamie Fluke. I'm the principal at Dayton Junior High and Dayton High School in Dayton, Oregon. And this has been a transformational experience. I can definitely say that, working with Thompson. And I've been in education for 23 years, and I've never experienced anything that has felt so right, and so it makes so much sense, and it's so relevant to what we're trying to do for our students to prepare them for the future. And just communicating with someone from the business world and being in the education world, it's just made it's given us the fuel to know that where we want to go and where we believe we should go is the right way to go, because we're talking to the businesses now and they're telling us this is what we need. And I think one of the things that we experienced prior to our partnership was we would refer to the real world in schools, and we really didn't know what that was. And teachers would say things like, well, in the real world, and we would think, you know, is that really what's happening? And to be honest, I think that we were way off of what the real world needs. So to have the representation or the voice of the real world coming to us and helping us help work collaboratively with us has given that a lot of, it's just given a lot of teeth to what we're trying to do and a lot of meaning and relevancy. And so we've spent the last 5 years doing a lot around developing a culture of collaboration at Dayton. This was prior to meeting Thompson, and working on working on our education and what's going on in the classroom, just a lot of the initiatives. We've moved to a proficiency-based model where kids are showing us what they know, applying their learning. So when we met Thompson, we were ripe for what he had to share with us, and I felt like it was the right time. And so we did. We we struck fast, we moved fast, and I don't think I've ever moved this fast with anything. But it is so incredibly exciting. I can't tell you. We meet, we do a Google Hangout every Thursday morning, early, and we call it innovation therapy, and we just talk about what's going on, and we have so many things happening. But to have that person to be able to share those concepts with, and in my mind, in education, we've always wanted to know, like, this is how it's got to look. We have it all figured out, and we have the steps laid out, and we take this approach. This agile approach is, if this makes sense, let's try it for a very short amount of time. Let's come back and see what we've learned, what we've gained, and let's pivot in that moment and make adjustments from there. And that is a huge cultural shift with educators, because that makes us all very vulnerable. We have to put ourselves out there and admit that maybe we thought we were going to try something and we learned these things, so now we need to move and shift a different direction. But that's ultimately what we want our students to do. And so this whole modeling and our teachers being students of this model. So when Thompson showed you that visual with the, when I saw that, I think of my teachers as my classroom, and to me, that was what I was trying to do with the teachers. It was like, we're learning, but we're also creating at the same time. We're taking this problem of education, of classroom instruction, and how do we take what we know and then go try it, instead of learning, and then trying it at the very end. So it's a simultaneous process. So I think that we tried our agile model, our first sprint, a month ago, and just this last Monday during our late start Monday, our teachers shared out how it went. So we modeled the whole concept of a sprint and then what the insights, and we're starting our next one. And it is hard work. It is energizing. It is the collaboration that's happening between the teachers. They're learning from each other, even though they're not in the same departments. And then that, in turn, part of the sharing out that they did is that the students are doing the same. In some of these projects, the teachers are defining a problem or a project based on the content that they're teaching. And then the students are helping each other out with, you know, hey, have you thought about this? Or I've heard about this, or I can help you with this. It is really transforming what we're doing. And our students are genuinely excited about what's happening. They don't exactly know everything that's happening, because it's all happening so fast, and it's happening as we're building it as we go. But I feel like we're being innovators. If everything we see about innovation is it's what we're feeling and it's what we're doing, and it's giving us as educators that relevancy of why we're there. It makes me feel like for the first time I can make a big difference. Like that incremental growth always feels like you're catching up and you finally get somewhere, and then it's like, oh, now we've got this. This is the first time I've ever felt like we're leapfrogging. We're doing things, and we're seeing kids, a majority of kids that traditionally don't find success in the traditional educational system, are finding their talents and that they didn't even know existed. Because in the traditional model, if you don't excel in some of these very basic things, it's hard to know what you could excel in. So we're giving them these experiences through Innovation 101 to know that you don't have to be techno to code and program. You know, you don't have to be. Invention doesn't come from a lightning bolt out of the sky. The people that have made inventions don't come up with them overnight and make $1 million. They try them over and over and over again. And so they're learning that you can have skill sets and be innovators and inventors and basically decide your own pathway. And what we're trying to do is create a model so that when they find those strengths and assets, that they can actually, we can provide them with a pathway or mentors or people that can help them grow, even if we don't have all the resources.
Okay. Great. Are you guys open for questions?
Absolutely.
I think we have some. Representative Wilson.
Thank you.
Or comments.
Mm-hmm. You know, to say I'm enthusiastic about what I've heard is a gross understatement. You know, this is something that I think most of us have intrinsically known for a long time, and that is we're constantly playing catch up. Mm-hmm. And leapfrogging is absolutely imperative, because any programs that we try to establish in hopes of improving on absenteeism and graduation rate, I think, are greatly futile until kids realize that they're going to that school every day for a real reason and a real purpose. The question that I have for you, and I'm going to have to take off here in a moment, but the question that I have that I really want to know, and that is, how do you change the culture? Everybody can be sensitive in any institution about seeing something that might indicate that they haven't been going the right direction. Could be administration, could be a school board. Who do you actually have to reach here to begin this process?
So that's a critical piece of the puzzle. So you're dealing with a very complex ecosystem. And so one of the things that was a key insight that came out of our work was when we met Heidi Seip out in Umatilla, who as a superintendent out there has completely transformed her district. And I asked Heidi, how do you do that? She said, don't forget, in Oregon, we're local controlled. We have guidelines, but I report to my school board. So as long as I have my school board to support me, I can make any change I want. I have to follow guidelines, but I am empowered by my school board. So what happened there is we realized that within our system, the superintendents played a very critical role to define permission around this. So what happened is we said, Heidi, you're outside the box. Are there other superintendents who also think the way that you do, that we have to reimagine? She said, oh, absolutely. She's been a member of COSA for many years, is on the board. I know who they are. We said, great, let's pull them all together. So we had an innovation summit that we held in August. We brought some leading innovative superintendents and said, what if we reimagined this? In partnership with our business community. And out of that came all this energy to say, yes, we can. It starts with yes, we can. And then what happens is then you have to go in and work with the principals. So in case, like, I'll give you an example down in Central, right? Buzz is the superintendent down there. He said he is one of our leading innovators in education. But he's the superintendent. The real work for him is to give permission. And the permission, and in case of Dayton, we had Janelle. The permission has to come from the superintendent. And then the principal is where the hard work happens. And so down in Central, we're working with Greg Mitchell. And same way that Jamie is the person who, she is the leader of that building, she defines the culture, she is the one who has to say, we are going to make this happen. And that's where the hard work happens. It's the culture change in the building. But everything needs to be aligned. We talk about aligning policy, platform, and practice. So the other piece of this is that you have to align policy, and this is the work that I've been doing with the STEM Investment Council, working with Mark Lewis and the rest of the council, to define our new STEM strategy for the state, and that is going to be released shortly, and that starts with a manifesto, an audacious manifesto of transformational change. So policy needs to be aligned, because that's how we begin to align ODE to support this innovation. But the practice is the critical piece, and that's why we had to go down to Dayton and to say, could we actually develop a new practice, and could that practice transform a culture, and could that culture then be replicated elsewhere? And that's what's going on. So it's a complicated answer only because it is a complicated environment. Mm-hmm. Key, though, is alignment. If we all desire to go there, it is only our fears that are getting in the way. You heard those students in front of those four young women who are here before us. They are fearless. Our students are fearless. Mm-hmm. The problem is not that our students have the growth mindset. This is one thing I've learned. Mm-hmm. We don't have the growth mindset. It is us who is the problem. And so as soon as we admit that, and we say we're going to go into a place that's... And one of the great things I teach when I work with Jamie's teachers, I say, in my world, we have to learn to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. You cannot innovate without being willing to walk into that place of discomfort. And so what Jamie has done is to say, I get it, and I'm going to model that. So she has modeled being comfortable, being uncomfortable. She's modeled that, and her teachers begin to see that as well. So it's that modeling that behavior and modeling that being able to fearlessly walk into that place of uncertainty.
I hope we can speak again.
Okay, other questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And piggybacking on what Representative Wilson said, because I'm sitting here thinking, this is great. I love it. What about the culture? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's all about the culture. So to you, Jamie, talk to me about how that shift is occurring, if it's truly occurring, mm-hmm. in your building, mm-hmm. with your staff members. Because we know in schools we have new programs, new reforms, we use that word a lot, all the time, and there's this hum of, yeah, we'll do this for a little bit, but it's going to go away too. Mm-hmm. And there never really is, things are not acculturated.
Yep.
So talk to me about that.
Well, that's where I feel, I guess, is that's where my expertise, I guess, comes in, is where I feel like the practice of what we've done. So when I was the middle school principal for 11 years, and then our high school principal retired, so I took the high school job too, but we're on the same campus. So my first challenge was I had worked with my middle school for quite some time, and we had developed this culture. Even though I'd worked closely with the high school staff, it's different when mm-hmm. when you know them versus when you're leading them and they see you in that role. So my first challenge was really kind of identifying those key pieces of having a healthy culture. And one of those is trust and collaboration. And that sounds so simple, but to collaborate doesn't mean to sit at the same table and just talk and share, and then nobody ever questions anything or ever gives feedback. They just want everything to be really great. So we modeled our Late Start Mondays that we have, that we've just implemented. We're significant time. We're our learning time, basically, our professional time. And so what we would do is model. I would give them a lot of different ways to model collaboration, and we would model good teaching strategies, and we would model different types of things, and I would with them, and then they would talk about them, and then they would share out to where they could start to see they got more comfortable, and they started to trust each other, and that the junior high staff was trusting the high school staff, and they were all, so it took, that takes time, and that's part of that piece is really knowing your people and knowing how to mix them up a little bit and get them, just like we do with our kids. I mean, I do really think of them as my students. You know, it's like, how would I do this with kids? And you've got to get them to a place where they can trust and be comfortable. And then, so we spent a lot of time learning together as a culture, and not being afraid to talk about things that may be uncomfortable, and to be able to say, this is why we're doing this, and to help believe in this greater vision. Probably the biggest cultural shift that we made, and I won't say that it's necessarily the reason, but I would say it took us through a tough culture shift that made us realize we can do anything after we did this. And that was back a couple years ago when the proficiency model came out, and it made 100% sense to me. This is the way that we should be looking at student learning and growth, is based on what they know and what they can show us. But trying to do something like that without sort of the backing of some legislature to say, hey, we need to relook at this, we need to report out behaviors and academics differently, that was just what I needed to say, I'm doing this, we're going forward. And that in itself was the hugest cultural shift we made, and it was tough. It was a hard time because it challenged traditional, you know, what we've known for hundreds of years and the way things have been done. But we stuck with it, and that was that year where everybody struggled, and it was, how do we work together? And that's where the biggest trust, I think, came about, was when we made this transformation. But if that transformation, if it would have been that difficult to collaborate or anything that we wanted to change, but that piece right there, we worked together, we continued to learn, and we grew, and we realized that just because it was uncomfortable didn't mean we weren't going to stop. We, even when, you know, things didn't work right, we're going to figure it out. We're going to bring it back to the table and say, what's working, what's not, how do we make this work? It took 1 year, and really that shift has happened. Mm-hmm. And it was big. But from there, I think that added trust has grown. And then also now when we start talking about these new ways of educating students or how we want to look at that, it's made they trust. They trust that I wouldn't ask them to do something that I'm not going to come right alongside of them the whole way through. And when they fail or when they fall, I'm going to be right there just as they are for me. And so it's this trusting relationship that we've been able to build. But you have to know your people and know where they're at and what they need.
Okay, other questions? And I think just a couple of comments because, I taught before most of the people, well, some of the people in the audience were adults at that time. But and I came out of a school district that still does have a lot of technology stuff and career ed and so on and so forth. But, the one thing about many of the reforms are never done by educators. They're done by somebody who runs a business, no offense, but they don't work with them. And so, we're supposed to be doing all of these reforms that we don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And we know are not good reforms, and yet, we have to do that. But I think the one thing about this program that is very good is that not only aren't kids engaged, and you can do this in social studies. I had kids that all of a sudden said, okay, we just finished a unit on whatever. What would have happened if the United States did not win World War II? Now you tell me what U.S. history would now be like if we didn't win World War II. And then they would, start working in groups and come up with that. So you can do it in a lot of other subjects. But I think the most important thing is it keeps kids in school. And it's those kids that all of a sudden have not been able to succeed in anything traditionally, all of a sudden say, I'm really good at this. And, whether it's coding or whatever. And so I think that's a very, very important thing. And teaching kids to collaborate. We used to teach them to think. We don't teach them to think anymore. And I think this of anything is the best thing you guys are teaching. Mm-hmm. Teaching students is that you think, you collaborate, you come up with something, you revise it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with the collaboration, when you're building a house, you have to collaborate. You have to collaborate. And it sounds like very good. I'm glad that Representative Reardon spoke very highly of the presentation. I'm glad we're able to do that. Anything else before we go on to the next thing?
I just thank you for being here. Obviously, I think you made a little impression, and I hope we can continue working together and let us know how we can support you. I'm really glad you're on the STEM Council. Yeah.
And I think the one thing that education leadership in the building is essential.
Yes.
And that is something that sometimes is not easy to learn. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully Old Coast and OSBA are doing more of the education leadership in buildings because that's where it comes from. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay. We have to close the informational hearing on technology innovation. The last thing we're going to do before we adjourn, 20 minutes early, is talk about committee bills because we have three committee bills that we can have. And so far, I just was going to give you a summary of what we've got so far. One of the bills is a fix-it bill that's been brought to us. And those of you that have been around for a while, the short session, we always fix things from the long session. But some of on the fix-it bill, and we're going to be submitting the language to LC by the end of the week. And it's things like that have come to us, a boundary change for fix for Beaverton Hillsboro, mm-hmm. an adjustment to ELL data, a fix on a charter school facility location we talked about before, and then also an administrator sunset removal for K-12 virtual school, and we'll be talking about that, but it's one of the kind of easy fix. And so one of those is going to be the fix-it bill. One is going to be possibly a bill on bullying, especially cyberbullying, and then a PERS sunset removal for speech pathologist. But we're open to suggestions.
Quote, fix-it bill, and I'm familiar with some of those issues, and at least the ones I'm familiar with truly are fixes, although we always get nervous when we hear fix-it.
Yeah.
Are those ideas primarily brought by OSBA?
They're brought...
Because I had some conversations also about these
issues. Actually, they're brought by... at least with these, the whole group, OSBA, COSA, OEA. And the one thing about the fix-it bills is that they can't be controversial. People have to be agreeing, in the first place. And I think with the short session, if the concept is controversial, then it needs almost to be introduced separately as opposed to a fix-it bill. So these are the sort of things that we're looking at. And then any other ideas? These, the deadline's next Thursday, I believe, and these were the things that have been brought to us so far. Okay? Any questions? Just wanted to let you know what's going on. Okay, anything else before we adjourn? Okay. And so anyway, you guys have a good holiday. Thank you. See you in January. And so with that, I adjourn the meeting for Interim House Education. And thank you, Victoria. Interim House Education. And thank you, Victoria. Adjourn the meeting for...